from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, earlier today, the United States Supreme Court dealt a defeat to the Obama administration, ruling that closely held companies cannot be forced to cover some types of contraceptives for their employees. Owners of Hobby Lobby, a chain of craft stores, had argued that the Obamacare contraception coverage mandate required them to pay for methods they oppose on religious grounds. In the hour ahead, we discuss the implications of the Hobby Lobby decision, as well as other major rulings of the court's latest term. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. The United States Supreme Court rendered two decisions earlier today as they head toward the end of their 2013 term. The court actually ruled 5-4 in Burwell versus Hobby Lobby that employers with religious objections can opt out of providing contraception coverage under Obamacare. Two companies, Hobby Lobby, a chain of craft stores, and Conestoga Wood Specialties, had argued that the contraceptive mandate would make them pay for contraceptive methods that they oppose on religious grounds. We're going to talk about this as well as another case that was rendered today, also 5-4. The Supreme Court ruled allowing some public workers to opt out of union fees. It was a narrow decision as well, and that decision was written by Justice Alito, and he essentially set up another category of government employees, a partial public employee category, and said they can opt out of joining a union and not be required to contribute dues to that particular labor group. This came about as a result of some home care aides in Illinois who were essentially in the case Harris versus Quinn saying that they had the right to do that. We're going to talk about these and other cases. In fact, we've got a lot ahead of us because we want to talk about some of the other cases that were rendered last week and also some cases that were not rendered that actually hit close to home here. Let me tell you who is joining us. Rory Little is here with us in studio, professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. And welcome, Rory. Good to have you.
Thanks, Michael. Good morning.
Good morning to Vikram Amar, also joining us, professor of law, now associate dean for academic affairs at UC Davis School of Law. Welcome, Vikram Amar.
Good morning, Michael.
And we'll also say good morning to Elizabeth Slattery, who is senior legal policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation and who joins us this morning from the nation's capital. Welcome, Elizabeth Slattery.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And let me get your take, if I could, initially on the Hobby Lobby case, since you're sort of Heritage and what is often identified as a more conservative view of this. Pleased by the decision by the Justice Alito? And if so, why, please?
Yes, we're absolutely pleased with the decision. You know, today the Supreme Court recognized that Americans do not lose their religious freedom when they go into business and that religious liberty rights are not restricted to the home or just to church.
And that means what in terms of the Affordable Care Act? It really doesn't affect it as such. It's still pretty much intact, thanks to Justice Roberts, who kind of took a different turn in this particular case.
Yeah, so what we have here is a few closely held corporations that are family-run businesses that had an objection to one of the regulations that was issued pursuant to when Congress passed the Affordable Care Act. And as a result of this HHS mandate that they allege violates their religious beliefs, they will not have to comply with that portion of the law.
This is corporations as individuals again, or is it, and what does it have to do with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993?
Well, so today the court recognized that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, also called RFRA, it does apply to corporations like Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, which is a Mennonite cabinet maker in Pennsylvania. You know, the law says that the government cannot substantially burden a person's free exercise with some caveats. And today the court recognized that persons in that statute does include corporations.
Well, we're also going to get some response on the other decision that was rendered earlier today about unions as public employees. But I want to pursue this a little more with you and go back to last week with you, if I could, because there was a 35-foot buffer zone on abortions that was changed. And I noticed Gail Collins in her column in the New York Times over the weekend said protesters are not actually allowed within 250 feet of the building where justice is rendered. But this McCullen versus Coakley also involves First Amendment rights. Can I get your take on that, Elizabeth Slatterly?
Sure. So in that case, the state of Massachusetts basically set up a 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics that included public sidewalks, and they were prohibiting sidewalk counselors, peaceful protesters, and basically anyone who didn't have direct business at the clinic from being on the sidewalk.
Let me bring Dipti Singh into this. She's staff attorney for the National Health Law Program, and I'd be interested if you have a response to the decision on abortion clinics. But first, let's go, if we could, with you and get your response to what you heard from Elizabeth Slattery on the Hobby Lobby victory.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on. And, you know, today I think we're incredibly disappointed in the court's decision. It has today sanctioned discrimination against women, allowing employers to decide whether or not their employees will have access to preventative care that medical experts recognize as essential. And it's a disappointing day.
Disappointing also last week with the decision about protesting in the buffer zone on abortions?
Absolutely. It has been a tough week for women for access to reproductive health care services. So that decision also didn't recognize the importance of access to these clinics, the harassment that women often face when they're trying to access reproductive health care clinics that are a constitutionally protected right. So we, too, are disappointed in that decision.
Do you know what the Hobby Lobby decision means for California? Aren't there additional protections under state law here?
That is correct. So currently we have a state contraceptive equity law, which requires health plans to cover a variety of FDA-approved methods. That law still stands. It was upheld by the California Supreme Court. The RFRA decision does not apply to state laws. And so here in California, we still have access to that coverage. There's also a bill that is currently working its way through the legislature, and what that would do is ensure that all FDA-approved methods of contraception are covered and also add the protection of no cost sharing, which is very important.
Again, Dipti Singh is staff attorney with the National Health Law Program. We thank you for joining us on Forum this morning. And as I said, we're joined for the hour by Elizabeth Slattery as well as Rory Little and Vic Amar. And Rory Little, let me go to the second decision with you. It seems to have some pretty strong ramifications. Unions for decades could collect dues from private or public employees that they were required to represent. And now you've got these eight home care workers in Illinois who challenge that law, even though the union is required to represent them.
Well, yes, the Harris versus Quinn case, we should point out, is a First Amendment case. The Hobby Lobby case is purely statutory. The Illinois structure is a very unique structure, and the good news about Harris versus Quinn is the court did not overrule a case called Abood from 1977 that allows public sector employees to have an exclusive bargaining relationship with the state. And it did not say that Abood is exempt in some sense for all public employees across the board. So in other words, teachers, other public employees, university professors, et cetera, are all still covered by the prior law. So the implications here are going to have to be worked out yet. Both the Hobby Lobby case and the Quinn case today are cases where the court proceeds somewhat narrowly and qualifies its opinion, saying it doesn't apply here, it doesn't apply there. So there's lots of litigation to come from both of these cases.
And they were both 5-4 decisions, and we'd had about three-quarters of decisions, first time since 1940, that were rendered unanimously.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a myth that they were so unanimous. The two cases last week, for example, were posed as 9-0 cases. But the reality is the justices split 5-4 in both of them as to how far they should go and what they mean for the future. And usually the court is about 50% unanimous. And so John Roberts, the Chief Justice, has said he wants unanimity if he can get it. And he wants to go narrowly if he can get it. And I do think he's having some influence, but they're not nearly as unanimous as some of the op-ed writers might suggest.
And Vic Amar, I read your piece about the Hobby Lobby. This is kind of unexpected where you were concerned, wasn't it? I mean, your two prongs, as you put in your article?
No, actually, the court kind of did what I and other people expected. As Rory pointed out, you know, they ruled in favor of Hobby Lobby, but they did so in a way that doesn't kind of resolve all the questions down the road. For example, the court leaves open whether publicly traded companies, unlike closely held family corporations, will easily be able to assert religious exercise rights under the RFRA. Moreover, the court goes out of its way to say, just because it's easy to grant Hobby Lobby an exemption here doesn't mean that we would be granting exemptions to employers who, for religious reasons, don't want to comply with anti-discrimination laws that protect African Americans or women or others. So it was a narrow case. And indeed, even the abortion protest case you mentioned earlier was narrow in the sense that, and as Rory pointed out, that was 9-0, but the court really broke down 5-4. The court did not apply very, very rigorous scrutiny to the law simply because it selected abortion clinics as a locus for regulation. That's what the conservatives wanted. They wanted to basically strike down, under a very strict standard, all laws that specify abortion clinics as special places where speech can be constrained a little bit. And Chief Justice Roberts didn't go along with them. He joined the more liberal justices and said, this law excludes too much speech, but we're not going to characterize every law that treats abortion clinics differently than other places as presumptively invalid. So the general tenor of all these cases is a move to the right, but there were some breaks on that. The Abood case that Rory referred to is hanging by a thread. The court really disparaged that case, but stopped short of reversing it or overruling it. I would expect down the road that Abood will go by the boards, but at least for today, it's still there.
There was a circuit split on this, too. I mean, we should mention that. There were actually three federal courts which struck it down and two appellate courts which upheld it.
You're talking about the Hobby Lobby?
Yeah.
Yes. Oftentimes the court will grant review because there is a circuit split. There are some statutes like the Obamacare statute and the Religious Freedom Restoration statute where even if there hadn't been a split, I think the court would feel the need to step in and to provide some clarity. And, you know, going to your point about these being 5-4 decisions, remember, at the end of the term, you always get the most difficult, contentious, most hard-fought over cases. They, you know, earlier in the term, the court releases decisions that were easier to come by. The end is always chock full of the blockbuster divided cases.
And let me, if I could, go to you, Elizabeth Slattery. I mean, how do you read this in terms of a move to the right, as Vic Amar put it, by the court, and particularly where it comes to federal authority or the diminution of federal authority?
I wouldn't necessarily say this is a huge shift towards the right. You know, as one of the other panelists pointed out with Hobby Lobby, the court said it's a little bit easier to grant them, the ability to bring a RFRA claim, because RFRA is all about balancing of interests. And, somebody mentioned, a company being able to discriminate against people based on race. And I just don't think that would fly under RFRA because, it's really a balancing of the government need and the religious liberty right.
Yeah, I should mention RFRA is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993, which I referenced earlier. But what does this mean for corporate personhood, for example, Elizabeth Slattery?
You know, that remains to be seen. I don't think that that we're going to see a flood of corporations making religious claims now. I think that, the HHS mandate at issue in Hobby Lobby was just something that, religious organizations and religious groups have been warning the administration when the initial proposed rulemaking, was floated in the first instance, that it would have serious implications for religious freedom. And, so I don't think that this decision necessarily portends anything specific to granting corporations more rights.
Well, Vic Amar, I know you were concerned about that, and there's been a lot of talk about vaccines and transfusions and what people can deem of religious importance to argue here.
Well, so let's explain exactly what the court said in Hobby Lobby. The court said that because we could simply ask the insurance companies to pick up the tab for providing this contraceptive coverage, there's no reason to force Hobby Lobby to violate its kind of religious principles and pay for and facilitate the contraceptive coverage itself. So the question in every case under the RFRA is, Is there another way to accomplish the government's goal without imposing on the individual or corporation who claims a religious tenet? And, you know, when it comes to discriminating on the basis of race or gender, I don't see how you can accommodate religious discrimination without also imposing a big harm on women and African Americans and other minorities. So I don't think the court is going to go there. With respect to things like blood transfusions, and vaccinations, it's quite possible that if a religious employer, or a religiously motivated employer, doesn't want to pay for that coverage because it violates their religious tenets, that the court would say the same thing it said in Hobby Lobby, that, well, the insurance company can pick it up on their own and we don't have to impose on the employer. You know, the court didn't reach those questions here, but the general thrust of its reasoning in this opinion is where there is a pretty easy accommodation to provide, then the RFRA requires that we provide it.
And yet, this is saying, isn't it, Rory Little, that the corporation has a right to exercise freedom of religion?
Yeah, I think it's a much more threatening case on that score. I think that's the big news of today. Now, let's be clear. They're construing the word person in a statute. They're saying the statute includes the corporation. But Justice Ginsburg, in her dissent, says this is Citizens United for freedom of religion, and it's going to lead to other problems. And I would take issue with one point. I think there is now going to be a flood of challenges. Any corporation who is interested in cutting its costs, which by law they generally have to be, and providing the profit for its shareholders, is going to say we could cut some costs if we could get out of some other things. Now, they're going to have – this is going to put the court in the middle, or the lower courts in the middle of deciding whose religious views are sincere and how strong are they and what's a substantial burden. This really opens that entire set of floodgates.
In fact, if I may, this was not only Hobby Lobby, it was also Conestoga, another company that brought this forward in terms of a case. One is owned by a Southern Baptist, and the other is owned by a conservative Mennonite, so you have different sects here, too.
You do, and you also have a lot of employees. We're talking 13,000 employees for the Hobby Lobby Corporation. So the religious rights of the owners, if you will, have to be held in contradistinction to the religious rights of the employees. I think this is an unfortunate opening up of a very large set of cases, and they didn't have to do that. The word person ought to be construed as person.
Can I get you on record here, Elizabeth Slattery, particularly in terms of that divide between the owner of the company and the employees?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, what it comes down to, a corporation is simply a form of an organization used by people. And, you know, the rights of the people running Hobby Lobby and Conestoga need to be respected.
And what about the employees?
Well, they've chosen to work there, and you know, with the women aren't being denied access to anything. There are still other ways that they can access, you know, the type of birth control that they decide with their doctors is appropriate for them. And I think one thing that's not gotten out a lot in the press with this, there were I think 20 different FDA approved contraceptions mandated by this mandate, and Hobby Lobby and Conestoga have no problem with 16 out of the 20. So they're really just fighting over four types of contraception that they have a problem with.
Vic Amar?
So again, you know, I think that recognizing Hobby Lobby's RFRA rights here does kind of open the door to some other litigation. There's no question about that. But the court had already held that individuals who are running businesses for profit are protected. And it had also held that nonprofit corporations are protected. So as a matter of interpreting the statute, they felt, and rightly or wrongly, that they couldn't draw a line between nonprofit corporations and for-profit corporations the way Justice Ginsburg wanted them to in the dissent. The court did stop short of saying that publicly traded corporations will be able to invoke these rights. That's still a question to be decided down the road. And as Rory points out, that lower courts are going to have to work through this. But in some ways, Hobby Lobby was an easy case once we said that Hobby Lobby could invoke the RFRA, because the accommodation was so easy to give, that is, to ask the insurance companies to pay for the contraception. There's a lot of other kinds of cases where the accommodation is not going to be so easy to imagine without imposing a lot of other burdens on the employees or third parties. And it's in those cases where the court will have to decide kind of how powerful RFRA really is.
Well, I'm looking at some listener responses here, and let me get them on record. Here's a tweet from Johnny who says, just to be clear, Hobby Lobby is still cool with paying for my vasectomy and Viagra, right? Another listener writes, there is no agreed-upon definition of closely held corporation. For federal tax purposes, it means a company that is not publicly traded and has no more than 100 shareholders in a single class. This definition includes some of the largest companies in the country, example, Koch Brothers. How can this kind of company be said to have religious opinions? Can I go to you on this, Professor Slattery?
Sure, although I would note I'm not a law professor, just a legal scholar at Heritage. So I think, you know, it's a unique situation with Conestoga and with Hobby Lobby, because what you have here are closely held family-run businesses. So it's pretty easy to determine the religious beliefs of the organization because they're run by a single family, you know, owned and operated by a small group of people, and so there's no disputing the sincerity of their religious beliefs. But I want to just bring it back again to RFRA, because RFRA is a balancing test, and so that doesn't mean that the people asserting their religious rights are always going to win. If the government can show a compelling interest in some sort of law that burdens religious freedom, and it's the least restrictive means, then the government wins.
Well, I have a question from a listener to you directly, Elizabeth Slattery. A woman named Judith says, would you please ask the representative of the Heritage Foundation how she proposes to protect the rights of women to obtain quality, complete, and safe medical care? What are our rights?
Well, this is not denying anyone access to medical care. It's just shifting who has to pay for it. When Congress passed the Affordable Care Act, if they wanted to do this as a tax and have everybody contribute for the things that they're mandating through the HHS mandate, they could have done it that way, but that would have been harder to get through Congress. And so, you know, this is not about access. This is just about who has to pay for it.
And Rory Little, here's a listener, Mike, who says, if the government cannot force closely held corporations to spend money on contraception because their owners believe that contraception destroys a human life, then how could they force a company owned by Quakers to pay taxes to support the military whose whole purpose is to destroy human life?
Well, interestingly enough, that's a very good question. Interestingly enough, Justice Alito goes out of his way to say what he's not doing in Hobby Lobby. He says, I'm not interfering with the precedents that say everyone has to pay taxes. I'm not interfering with employment discrimination laws, at least those based on race. There's so much qualification in the opinion, you sort of wonder if he doesn't feel a bit defensive about going as far as he went. And it's important to recognize these closely held corporations are for profit. They have chosen the corporate form in order to make money. So when you say we're shifting who has to pay for it, we're shifting it away from a corporation that has knowingly chosen a corporate form as opposed to staying in a sole proprietorship or a family-run business. And they've decided we're going to choose that form to enable us to make more profit, but we're not going to pay for things that we don't think we should have to pay for.
Well, let me open the phone lines and invite more listener involvement in not only this case, the Hobby Lobby case, which has got a good deal of interest, to put it mildly, and a lot of focus on, but also Supreme Court ruling, which is going to allow some public workers to opt out of union fees. Both decisions were rendered earlier today, and you may indeed want to talk about just what has gone on over the course of 2013 with respect to the United States Supreme Court now ending that term of 2013. And a lot of decisions were rendered last week, which we didn't have an opportunity to talk about on forum, and you may indeed want to represent your own opinions now or raise questions or comments about how the court is going and so forth. We do welcome your involvement in the program. You can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email us forum@kqed.org or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can tweet us as well. Our Twitter handle, again, is @KQED Forum. Talking with Rory Little, Professor of Law, UC Hastings College of the Law, Vikram Amar, who is Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at UC Davis School of Law, and Elizabeth Slattery, Senior Legal Policy Analyst with the Heritage Foundation. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the Supreme Court and its decisions. Two were rendered earlier today, and those decisions had to do with allowing some public workers to opt out of union fees and also the decision that we've been talking about for the most part, which is Hobby Lobby, which has to do with contraception payments for corporations or companies that are essentially run by or owned by those with religious beliefs. And a lot of cases were rendered last week, as many of you well know, on cell phones, on Aereo, on Senate recess. Hope we can, in the course of this hour, get to those, the buffer zone on abortions. But I'm really kind of opening it to you, our listeners, to find out what particularly you want to know and what is of interest to you. And any questions or comments from you are certainly welcome and invited. Our toll-free number again, should you care to join us, is 866-733-6786, and you are indeed welcome to join the conversation. Again, that toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Elizabeth Slatterly is with us, Senior Legal Policy Analyst with the Heritage Foundation, and so is Vikram Amar, Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the UC Davis School of Law. And Rory Little here in studios, professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law. And I just wanted to, before we go to your calls and emails and talk about these decisions and talk about where the court is moving and what kinds of assumptions or conclusions we can rein in as a result of these recent decisions, particularly Supreme Court, just to get local for a minute with you, Rory, very different cases, but they turned down the Drake's Bay Point Reyes Oyster Farm appeal. They rejected the challenge to a law banning gay therapy, and they also did not wish to hear a dispute over California's fuel standard. Talk a little bit about how they decide, we're going to go with this or we're not going to go with this.
Yeah, well, the process of getting review by the Supreme Court is a pretty difficult process. They take far less than 1% of their cases every year. They grant oral argument, let's just say, in 75 cases out of, you know, over 7,500 petitions for review. So it's not a guarantee that you're going to get review, even if you have a very good case, even if you lost in a way you thought was erroneous, things like that. The Drake's Bay case, of course, has a lot of local attraction here, but the Solicitor General of the United States was asked and recommended against it, and there didn't seem to be a national dispute among circuits. And so that's a case that no matter how important it may be to us, the court is unlikely to take. The fuel standard case, they decided a couple of big EPA cases this year. They talked about greenhouse gases and things. I think maybe they just wanted to let those cases be reconsidered or rethought, you know, in light of what they did do this year. It's very hard. Lots of cases are denied every year, and lawyers would say, boy, they should have taken that one. They often don't take a case, even though they know it presents a good issue, because they're looking for a better vehicle or they're looking for another circuit to decide a similar case.
I just want to go back to a note that was made earlier, you know, when Vic Amar talked about maybe the court moving more to the right and Elizabeth Slatterly maybe not necessarily seeing it that way. I wanted to get you on record here because there was an article in the Washington Post that said what we've seen so far is a strong reluctance to accept even a modest limit on federal authority. The administration has been perhaps overreaching, some have argued, and this court might agree with, but the same was true for the Bush administration.
Yeah, I mean, the real truth in our system is that the judiciary performs a checking function on the executive branch and the legislative branch. And I think the Supreme Court today is asked more and more to do that, to check things. But they have the court is not necessarily all to the right. The cell phone case was a real unanimous decision, which said the government has to have a warrant in most cases before they can go through somebody's data on their cell phone. And the recess appointment case, where the court held that the president does have the power to fill vacancies during recesses, even if the vacancy happened before the recess. There's a lot of interesting political maneuvering to be done now in light of that decision, but it certainly was a case where the side of the court that is ideologically called the left side was the victorious side, and Justice Scalia dissented in a very vigorous way on the other side.
In that case, by the way, we were able to, and Justice Breyer has pointed this out, define what a recess is, maybe for the first time.
Yeah, I think of recess as going out to play kickball. The debate is historically, what did they mean by recess? And it turns out that people disagreed about what the meaning of recess was right from the very first administration with President Washington and his first attorney general, apparently, possibly at least, holding different views. And 250 years later, we just don't know. So, yeah, the court had to define recess. It had to define what it means for a vacancy to happen. They said that a recess of less than 10 days is presumptively not long enough, but maybe it is in some circumstances. There's a lot left to be done on that, and it's a fascinating exercise in history.
It's also, I think, I'm going to go to your calls in just a moment, though. Vic Amar wanted to just ask you about what appear to be three distinct voting blocks that continue. I mean, everybody talks about how Justice Kennedy is a swing vote, but just in terms of what might be the polarization on the court.
Well, you know, Justice Kennedy is often the swing vote, but so is Justice Breyer often. Chief Justice Roberts. For example, in the abortion protest case last week, it was Chief Justice Roberts that joined with the liberals to avoid a more conservative result. And, you know, to say that the court, you know, has an incremental drift to the right is not to say that, you know, this is kind of just revolutionary. But, you know, with the recent replacements of Justice Alito for O'Connor and Chief Justice Roberts for Chief Justice Rehnquist, you do have five more or less conservative votes. Justice Kennedy is a little bit more unpredictable. But in most of the 5-4 decisions, and those are the ones where I think you judge the direction the court's moving in, there's a gentle drift to the right. I want to make one other point about Hobby Lobby because, as you say, we might want to move on to some other cases. But I think a lot of people properly raised the question of well, who's paying for this? You know, why should the employer be let off of this obligation? And Rory pointed out, doesn't that create an incentive for other for-profit entities to seek more accommodations? One thing I would have liked the court to have done, and it didn't, and this is what a colleague at Davis, Alan Brownstein, and I wrote, is why not have – the employer doesn't want to pay for the contraceptive coverage, fine, but why not have them pay an amount into the federal treasury equal to the amount that they save by not having to pay for contraception, and that way they wouldn't benefit financially from their religious view. It's like conscientious objectors. They don't have to serve in the war, but then they have to provide some alternative service. The court could have done that and can still explore that in other cases, but I was sorry that the court didn't talk about that option.
What do you think about that option, Elizabeth Slattery?
I think that sounds like something that Congress could take up rather than the court.
Okay. Let's take up some of our callers, and we go first. Alex, to you. Good morning. You're on.
So that last comment is directly related to my comment. I'm CEO of a company here in Mountain View, several hundred employees, tens of millions of dollars in revenue, and I'm always trying to find a financial edge, and I'm wondering if I should find the most financially beneficial religion and join it to save on any number of costs. For example, I think Christian Science, you know, doesn't believe in vaccinations or certain kinds of responses to medical situations. It seems like this is a slippery slope, and maybe I should spend time on Google finding the best religion.
Well, Elizabeth Slattery, slippery slope has come up in this whole Hobby Lobby decision. You say what?
Sure, and that's a great question. Thank you for it. So I would point out, and I've said this a couple times now, that the federal law that Hobby Lobby and Conestoga were relying on, RFRA, it's a balancing test. And so just because someone claims that they have a religious objection to a law doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to win. The government can still prevail. And, you know, I applaud your efforts to lower your bottom line as much as you can, but you know, the sincerity of belief is something that would come up in court, and the sincerity of the beliefs of the Hahn family and the Greens, they're the families that run Conestoga, Wood, Specialty, and Hobby Lobby. The sincerity of their beliefs was not at issue in this case.
Well, here's Ben who writes, I mean, again, this gets right to the point of Hobby Lobby and the slippery slope. Ben says, what happens when a company believes in healing prayer? Does that mean I get no health care? Maybe I don't need to go to the dentist because I can chant my toothache away. Where is the limit? And you're saying it's with sincerity, essentially.
Sincerity, and again, looking at the government's compelling interest. In this case, the court said, you know, the asserted interest of gender equality and access to health care, you know, they didn't really dive deeper into whether those are compelling interests. They just said, we're assuming they're compelling interests, and we're moving on to a different part of the analysis.
Oh, are we on a slippery slope here, Rory Little?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that this is a statutory case. I think you're going to see Congress trying to pay attention in a more detailed way. I think the idea that Vic has put out there, for example, is a very attractive and creative idea. And I think our other speaker is right that this is probably something you have to do statutorily. The court couldn't impose it necessarily themselves. But I do think you're going to see congressional attention here because of this can of worms that is now opened. Up until today, for-profit corporations were not covered by RFRA, at least in any binding decision. After today, they're going to go back to the drawing board. We'll see whether political compromise is possible here, and it may not be.
Here's Eric. Eric, join us. You're on. Hi.
Yeah, I have a question regarding the case for the Hobby Lobby. It seems that their argument is that it would be too, you know, they don't want to pay for contraception, but I don't know if you've had a child recently, you probably know that it costs well into five figures for a birth. So I'm wondering how they can make this claim when perhaps contraception might do its job and eliminate or prevent a couple of unwanted pregnancies to be sure.
Well, I just want to get some clarity on this, and Vikamar, you might want to respond to Eric's question, but also we're talking about a specific kind of contraception here, aren't we, morning after, as opposed to, say, condoms or anything like that?
Yeah, as Elizabeth pointed out, there's a number of FDA-approved contraceptive methods, and Hobby Lobby objected to some of those on religious grounds. There's a legitimate question about how much it actually costs to provide this contraceptive coverage, and indeed the court tended to suggest that if the insurance companies provide it themselves, they may even save money because it's cheaper to provide contraception than it is to deal with pregnancies that otherwise could be avoided. Those cost insurance companies a lot of money. It's not clear what the costs are, but the court did not think in this case that giving an exemption to Hobby Lobby was really going to generate a lot of cost. I mean, this goes back to something Elizabeth and Rory said. You know, if the slippery slope turns out to be real, then maybe Congress will step in, although politically, as Rory points out, Congress doesn't really do very much these days. But I think the court's instinct in this case to rule in favor of Hobby Lobby was driven in part by its belief that there are not a lot of others out there who are going to be making claims that are going to cost the system a lot of money. Now, the court could be wrong. It's not always right about the way the real world operates, but I think the court isn't worried about publicly traded corporations or vaccinations or blood transfusions or claims involving race or gender so much because it doesn't think that those are going to be made, or it thinks that they're going to involve so much cost that it'll be easy for courts to deny exemptions in those cases.
Rory Little, we'll go back to Hobby Lobby, but I want to get back to Harris-Quinn, which again was decided earlier today. All of this fear, that particularly because Alito is writing the opinion, which has a lot to do perhaps with ultimately what the opinion was, but there's a great deal of fear that it would wipe out public employees unions. Let's put this to rest. It's not going to happen, but what about the consequences of this decision?
Well, it's another case that's going to have to open up, I think, further litigation. First, the majority, Vic is right, the majority sort of invites a challenge to overrule the Abood case. The Abood case is what permits this public sector unionism with exclusive bargaining agents to exist. It's been around for 40 years, and many, many states have decided it's a good idea. They don't have to adopt that system, but if they do, there's a federalism argument that says they should be allowed to. We're going to now see challenges to Abood. We're also going to see challenges depending on the type of employee. There's this new category now called partial public employee. The Illinois system really is quite unique and quite unusual. It has been replicated in some other states, but I think you're going to see a lot of work done, and you may, again, see some congressional attention paid to this issue because, again, it's the court only has blunt tools. They only have the tools of deciding one case on the facts that are given. They don't have the luxury of being able to make policy decisions across the board even when the case doesn't necessarily present it. So often the justices express frustration, wish they would go back to Congress. Congress, on the other hand, wishes that the court would decide everything that's difficult.
We're seeing a new superstar in Paul Clement here, are we?
Paul Clement is he had some amazing cases. He was the lawyer in a case called U.S. versus Bond this term, which involved a kind of a romantic dispute and putting some mildly poisonous chemicals on doorknobs because a woman was unhappy that her husband was having a baby with another woman. And Paul Clement took that case and turned it into a huge constitutional challenge to the implementation of treaties and Congress's authority under Article 2. And he didn't win that argument, but he won the case for his client. His client's conviction was vacated.
Yeah, I'm just struck by how his – we had Ted Olson and David Boyce on Thursday because they've done a book on essentially they're fighting Proposition 8 with the Supreme Court. And, you know, they've argued a lot of cases, especially Olson in front of the Supreme Court. But Clement is going for the record here, it seems. Let me go back, if I may, Elizabeth Slattery, to you. Mary writes, I just heard the report on Morning Edition stating that this decision, talking about Hobby Lobby again, was a victory for religious groups. It's undoubtedly a victory for a particular religious viewpoint, but there are many religious groups who wholeheartedly support full health care coverage for women, which would include contraception.
I think that, you know, today's decision was a victory for all Americans, not just specific, religious groups. And there are over 100 different challenges in working their way through the various trial and appellate courts to different aspects of this mandate. And, you know, they run the gamut for different religions that are represented. And so it's not just Christians and Catholics who are objecting to the HHS mandate. It's a variety of religions that are represented.
Well, let me get your response, if I may, to another question that sort of dovetails. Another listener asks, how is it the right of any business to determine what form of medical practice my doctor might choose for me? If Hobby Lobby accepts some forms of contraception, how is it their business to decide which one?
Well, it's, you know, they're not deciding for their employees, you know, of the ones that they cover, you know, which ones they need their employees need to use. They're just saying the four types that they consider to be abortion-inducing drugs and devices. They have religious objections to paying for or providing coverage of those. You know, and the employees can still access the four types through a different means. It just comes down to who has to pay for it.
All right, I'm reading a web posting from Beth, who says, reminds us again that Hobby Lobby was not the only business that was involved in the case. Conestoga Wood Specialties Corporation of Easterl, Pennsylvania, owned by a Mennonite family, was also party to the case. One does not give up their First Amendment religious rights when they have a private business. And remember, the Obama administration gave exemptions to other religious-based groups and businesses. And here's Janice Vicamar, who writes, if we expanded Medicare in order to have national health insurance, issues like these would never arise again. Other countries marvel at our willingness to allow employers to decide issues about our health care.
Well, you know, that would have been one way to go, but there wasn't the political will to have kind of a single-payer national system, and so Obamacare is what we got. I want to come back to this question of religious liberty and equality, though, because there was another big religion case this year, the town of Greece versus Galloway, where the court was much less sensitive to religious values when it allowed a town in upstate New York to start its town board meetings with a prayer with invited local clergy from established congregations. And some individuals felt that they were pressured to participate in that prayer because they were going to be doing business with the city council, and they didn't want to look like a dissenter or a weirdo by not standing up when everyone else was standing during the prayer. And there the court 5-4 with Justice Kennedy not showing as much sympathy or sensitivity to religious liberty and equality said the town could do what it wanted to do. So, you know, when you put Hobby Lobby together with Town of Greece, that's what bothers some people, that religion seems to matter in some cases, but religious minorities don't seem to get respect in cases like Town of Greece.
Roy Little, this court, we're trying to kind of get see if we can get a hold on this court and the decisions that it's rendering overall in this last term. There were a lot of decisions they struck down in abstract software patent. This is what they call patent trolls, I guess. There was a ruling on class actions against securities fraud. There was a ruling on ESOP fiduciaries, which is confusing as hell. But it's kind of confusing to sort of sort it all through and see if we can come to some kind of notion of where this court is headed.
Well, you're going to see people trying to put a more generalized model, if you will, before us. But, the sort of unique thing about our Supreme Court is that it is a court of general jurisdiction and has not specialists appointed, but general sort of practitioner judges. And they decide cases that run the gamut. And they've got to understand DNA and software and cell phones and metadata and the variety of religions that have legislative prayers in the beginning of town hall meetings. I mean, it is a really remarkable enterprise. And I guess I'm saying the glass is half full or even better. They do a really good job of trying to provide national decisions on cases that deeply divide all kinds of segments on very complicated matters. If there's one thing that seems clear to me, it's just the opinions are getting longer and the footnotes are getting more detailed. And just the last 2 or 3 days worth of decisions I've got sitting here in front of me is about 4 inches of paper. This makes it pretty hard for the average person to even really gather what is going on.
But I remember reading how Rehnquist was beside himself with the lack of unanimity. Now, you said that unanimity has to be looked at with a bit of a skeptical eye here, these number of unanimous decisions, three-quarters of them. But this has really become the Roberts Court, and there's a definite trend not only toward perhaps leadership when it comes to rendering unanimity or what appears to be unanimity, but also seems to be more of a court functioning in the way, frankly, the court's supposed to function, more toward checks and balance.
Well, you know, I agree with that. I'm not necessarily – I'm on the left, I guess. But I think Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, has done a pretty good job. You can't make these justices do anything they don't want to do. But he's done a pretty good job of developing an ethic of respect, I think, of narrow decisions when they can be narrow, of unanimity when they can be unanimous. That doesn't prevent Justice Scalia and Justice Sotomayor from fighting dramatically. There was an affirmative action case this year. We forget three
months
ago. Yeah,
the Chouette case. I was going to bring that up. What do you mean?
And Justice Sotomayor wrote one of the most powerful, intensely personal dissents. I've got it in front of me here. She said things like, my colleague's sentiment is out of touch with reality. Race matters. Race matters. She repeats it twice. So there's still deep disagreements on this court. But I think Chief Justice Rehnquist would probably be pretty proud of his substitute here, Justice Roberts.
Well, here's a listener, and let me go again to you, Elizabeth Slattery, Holly, who writes again about a Hobby Lobby case. It means the expansion of a corporation as a person is furthered with religion, Citizens United plus others.
You know, as we've talked about how the two companies that were represented in the case, they're these, you know, family-owned businesses, and we're not talking about publicly traded corporations, and, you know, this isn't the sky falling and that corporations have, you know, all the same rights. But, you know, when it comes down to it, and this is something that the court pointed out, you know, a corporation is simply a form of organization used by human beings to achieve a desired end. So corporations further the rights of the people who run them.
Well, is this, you know, I think about the case, Vic Amar, that seemed to at least give some benefit to corporations. I'm going blank on the name of the case with the television industry and
Arrow.
Yeah, the Arrow case. Thank you. I mean, they went with the corporation on that.
They went with a corporation and they went again a corporation. I mean,
yeah, right.
All of those kind of business cases are pitting corporations against each other. You know, one thing.
But we're talking about the behemoth corporation.
Yeah,
really.
And sometimes they win. I mean, the Roberts Court is generally thought of as a court that's kind of pro big business. But, you know, these are not kind of inexorable trends. There were cases where big business interests won. For example, Daimler in Germany avoided a suit in California involving arising out of Argentina. But sometimes big businesses lose, too. You know, going back to Citizens United, there was another big campaign finance case this year where the same 5-4 kind of majority struck down yet another piece of campaign finance regulation. This one prohibited people from donating to too many candidates at once. There was an aggregate cap on the amount an individual could donate, and the court struck that down, again, embracing a very robust understanding of the protection of money in the political system. So that's kind of another conservative trend that's moved forward. But, you know, it's also important to note that this term was not a huge term by historical standards. There were some significant cases. Some of them fizzled, like the Bond case that Rory referred to involving congressional treaty power. I think actually two of the biggest cases are ones we've adverted to but not talked a lot about. Those are the cell phone cases. And those would have been really big had they come out the other way, had the court said that cops could search any data that's on cell phones when they arrest an individual. But given that that was kind of unanimous, I think everybody agreed that the court needed to draw a line there. It drew maybe a more absolute line than people expected, even though there are some exceptions. But, you know, this was not a blockbuster term the way we saw when the court decided the big Obamacare case, Michael, that you adverted to earlier, where Chief Justice Roberts really claimed the court as his own in upholding Obamacare as a general matter.
We'll bring on another caller. Nick, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking the call. To return to the Hobby Lobby case, my understanding is that the Supreme Court upheld the Obamacare mandate by calling it taxation. So does that mean that I can withdraw my taxation for things that I religiously don't agree in, say war or militarized police state?
Yeah, we had an email before about a Quakers and all that sort of thing. Rory Little shaking his head no here. Yeah,
they absolutely say you can't. In fact, they go out of their way to say this is not going to change the way we collect taxes.
Disappointed, Nick?
A little bit.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand the discrepancy between those two things.
Rory?
Well, what they, you know, they're applying a statute and they say, unlike the mandate in Hobby Lobby, there would be a compelling interest for the government to collect its taxes. And the way they do it, which is requiring everyone to pay taxes, is the least restrictive means. I think it shows that these tests, frankly, are somewhat manipulable. And I don't disagree with you that it is hard to understand that distinction, but they did say it very clearly in this opinion.
And, Nick, I thank you for the call. We will continue to watch, what goes on as a result of these decisions. I want to thank all of those who joined us, helping us understand to a much greater extent what went on earlier today and over the course of the court's last term. Rory Little, Professor of Law, UC Hastings College of the Law, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Vikram Amar, Professor of Law and Associate Dean for Academic Affairs, UC Davis School of the Law. Thank you, Vic.
Thank you.
And thanks to Elizabeth Slattery, who joined us by phone also, Senior Legal Policy Analyst with the Heritage Foundation. Thank you, Elizabeth Slattery.
Thanks for having me.
We also had Dipti Singh on with us, Staff Attorney with the National Health Law Program, and you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We remind you, you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.